Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1046, I will interview Dr. Ramzi Baroud about the ongoing Palestinian Nakba and the latest escalation of Israeli atrocities throughout occupied Palestine. Dr. Ramzi Baroud is a US-Palestinian journalist, media consultant, author, internationally syndicated columnist, editor of Palestine Chronicle, and a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs. But before that interview, I'd like to share with you that the award-winning, world-renowned Iraqi artist and distinguished oud player, Nasir Shamma, is currently touring the United States for live musical performances in different cities, including Houston. Nasir Shamma has a PhD in musical philosophy and has been recognized with over 60 awards from around the globe. He is well known for exporting his musical culture to Europe and has presented over 60 compositions that translate his musical vision. He launched the Arab Oud House, where he would orchestrate and manage the advancement of oud students to an expert level, sharing his techniques and additions to the instrument. By the way, Nasir Shamma is a respected humanitarian. Over the years, he made his humanitarian contributions in promoting peace across the world a priority, all the while using music to raise funds for a long list of vetted projects that serve his humanitarian vision. In Houston, Nasir Shamma will be joined by violinist Karen Briggs, bass guitarist Hova Borian, and percussionist Richie Garcia. The Houston musical performance will take place on Thursday, February 9th at 8 p.m. at the Wortham Theater Center. And so I will share a secret with you now. There is a promo code for that event that you can use when reserving online. And that code is SAWA2018. That's SAWA2018. I will have a link to that event with more information on our website, arabvoices.net, under the calendar section. Our guest in this episode of Arab Voices is Dr. Ramzi Baroud. We will talk about many issues and points, including why Israel is escalating its attacks on the Palestinians throughout the West Bank and particularly in Jenin, the reasons for the increased armed resistance to the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, Israeli theft of Palestinian artifacts and destruction of their archaeological sites, Israel's soft annexation of the West Bank, the Israeli Great Jerusalem Plan, home demolitions, the ongoing destruction in Sheikh Jarrah, Silwan, Khan al-Ahmar, Masafer Yatta, and other places. We will also talk about the Israeli control of Palestinian water resources, Israeli colonies, and the criminal acts of the Israeli colonizers. We'll talk about Palestine 48, the new Israeli government and its new measures and policies imposed on the Palestinians, the support of the US to Israel's crimes and its refusal to recognize Palestinians in the West Bank as occupied, Palestinian resistance and steadfastness, possible solutions to the crisis, and more. Joining us via phone from Seattle, Washington, is Dr. Ramzi Baroud to talk about the ongoing crisis in Palestine. Dr. Baroud is a U.S.-Palestinian journalist, media consultant, author, internationally syndicated columnist, editor of Palestine Chronicle, and a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs. He is the author of several books and a contributor to many others. The books he authored include Searching Jenin, Eyewitness Accounts of the Israeli Invasion, The Second Palestinian Intifada, A Chronicle of a People's Struggle, My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, Gaza's Untold Story, The Lost Earth, A Palestinian Story, These Claims Will Be Broken, and his latest volume, co-edited with Ilan Pappe, is titled Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. Dr. Ramzi Baroud's work has been published in hundreds of newspapers and journals worldwide, and he has contributed to and was referenced in hundreds of books and academic journals, and has been a guest speaker at many universities around the world. He is a regular guest on many television and radio programs nationally and internationally. Dr. Baroud, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you very much for having me, Said. Always a pleasure.
Thanks. It's good to have you again on the show. The situation in occupied Palestine has escalated dramatically over the past, specifically week, but really if we look at the history and year after year after year, the situation in Palestine is always in a crisis mode under a brutal Israeli military occupation. What we are witnessing there is really nothing less than ethnic cleansing. Could you share with our listeners, please, what is the situation now in occupied Palestine?
Absolutely. I think the term escalation here itself needs to be examined because, as you mentioned, I mean, the escalation has been going on for such a long time. But why is it that at certain times we feel that there is indeed a different kind of escalation, and at certain times we feel that it's business as usual? If we examine the numbers of Palestinians that were killed by Israel, for example, in 2022, I'm not talking about illegal Jewish settlement expansion. I am not talking about house demolitions, about the destruction of Palestinian farms and olive groves. I'm not talking about any of these things. I am only talking about the killing of Palestinians in the last year. You find out that more than 230 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank alone. The highest number of Palestinian casualties, according to the United Nations' own estimates, since 2005. What happened in 2005? That was the last year of the second Palestinian uprising, or the Intifada, where the daily killing was at a very high rate for 5 years between 2000 to 2005. And there was a degree of kind of, you know, Israel managed to create this kind of low-grade conflict in which it kills Palestinians here and there. It slowly kind of annexes Palestinian land, does all of these things without giving the impression that something very dramatic is underway. But in 2022, indeed, something that was very dramatic that took place, and that is the very high number of Palestinian casualties. Now, Palestinians, of course, noticed that. Arab media noticed that. The international community, aside from the U.S. and a few other benefactors of Israel, noticed that. And they've been talking out against it. Human rights organizations have been speaking out, warning that there is going to be an explosion. The spark has already been lit by Israel. And we are just waiting for that dramatic moment where Palestinians respond. And the Palestinian response happened last week, when a Palestinian young man acting alone targeted and killed seven Jewish settlers in the occupied East Jerusalem, city of East Jerusalem. And that's where the problem with the word escalation happens, is that the media only recognizes that there is an escalation and that calm is no longer underway when Palestinians there respond. This is precisely what happened, and that's why the term escalation is very problematic, because when Israel escalates against Palestinians, as it does and it has been doing for such a long time, nobody seems to notice, again, save the Palestinians themselves. When Palestinians, fed up, pushed to the absolute brink, fight back, that's where the escalation happens, and that's when Mr. Blinken, Antony Blinken, notices. So he immediately flies to the Middle East, meets with the Egyptians, the Jordanians, of course the Israelis and the Palestinians. What can we do to bring this situation under control? And Israel's security is our first and foremost priority in the Middle East, and Israel has the right to defend itself. Mr. Biden referred to the killing of the seven settlers as an attack on civilization. An attack on civilization. Well, the 230 Palestinians killed in 2022 and the 39 Palestinians killed in January alone, since January 1st, 2023, 39 Palestinians were killed. No such language was used whatsoever. No such mention of the victims or their rights under occupation or their political aspirations or their human rights. None of this was mentioned. Only when Palestinians respond, it's an escalation, and only when Israelis are killed, it's an attack on civilization.
And if you could talk about the Israeli massacre that took place in Jenin, which occurred on January 26, 2023, 10 Palestinians were murdered and at least 20 others were wounded.
That's right. Let's just back up just a little bit before we talk about Jenin, very briefly. There's a very important context that I feel like needs to be mentioned here. And that is, there's been a lot of talk about an armed rebellion in the West Bank. Why are we talking about armed rebellion? We're talking about armed rebellion in the West Bank because there is no political horizon whatsoever. The oppression by Israel and the violence of the armed Jewish settlers in the West Bank has been unprecedented. People are losing their land, their lives, their livelihoods, their freedom to travel, to move about. I had a friend here in the States who just came back from Jenin, from Al-Khalil, Hebron. He was there for 4 months. And I asked him, how was it? How was your visit to your family after all these years for 4 months? He said, I couldn't move. I couldn't. For 4 months, I was trapped. I couldn't go to Nablus. I couldn't go to Jenin. I couldn't go to Jerusalem. I couldn't go to Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray. I was trapped. And that's what Palestinians are like. We keep talking about the siege of Gaza, the siege of Gaza, which is very much true. But what we don't talk about is the siege of the West Bank, because the West Bank is divided not only to regions like Area A, B, and C, but these regions themselves are themselves divided and cut off from one another. And that creates this massive social and cultural and economic, let alone political, disruptions in the lives of Palestinians. The most isolated of these areas are the northern parts of the West Bank. We're talking about Jenin, Nablus, and their adjacent refugee camps, and Qalqilia to some extent. And this is why there is this brewing rebellion there, because people are being pushed to beyond their limits. Jenin, yes, 10 people were killed in Jenin just a couple of days before the attack on the settlers in East Jerusalem. But many Palestinians, especially youth, some of them are children, have been killed in Jenin in the last 2 to 3 years. And I've wrote extensively about this. I've been writing that we need to pay attention to what is happening in Jenin. And the reason I focused on Jenin is because of the book that I wrote with Noam Chomsky in 2002, Searching Jenin, Eyewitness Accounts of the Israeli Invasion. We spent a lot of time talking to people in Jenin, to the survivors of the victims of the massacre in Jenin in April 2002. And we discovered two major facts about Jenin. Number one, the people of Jenin are, you know, under no circumstance are going to give up. Extremely stubborn, extremely strong, extremely resilient. I mean, if Sumud can manifest itself in a specific region, anywhere in Palestine, it definitely will be Jenin. Extremely tough people, extremely proud people. And the second thing we discovered, that Israel is using Jenin as an example, a lesson to be taught to Palestinians. Like, if you misbehave, if you resist, if you fight back, your fate is going to be that of Jenin. So that's why the constant emphasis on Jenin. And Israel, of course, knows and has been talking about the approaching armed rebellion. Why approaching? What are they waiting for? They are waiting for a transition in the Palestinian Authority. They know that Mahmoud Abbas is quite old. There is no replacement that has any degree of legitimacy. Not that Mahmoud Abbas was extremely loved or legitimate in the eyes of Palestinians, but he comes from an older generation within the PLO, and he managed somehow to keep things moving forward. Once he is gone, there's a very good chance that the West Bank is going to rebel against the Palestinian Authority, against Israel, against the settlers. So there's a lot of weapons, a lot of resistance groups that are being formed. In Nablus, for example, you have the Lion's Den. In Jenin, you have the Jenin Brigades. You have the Balata Brigades. You have the Hebron Brigades. So Palestinians have been preparing for some kind of a rebellion. And Israel has been doing its utmost to stop this rebellion in its track by attacking and killing the leaders of this potential rebellion. They've assassinated many Palestinians in the last year in Nablus, in Jenin, and elsewhere. What the most recent incident, that takes us back now to the original question, the most recent incident in Jenin was supposed to be another attempt at eliminating, you know, several Palestinian activists, fighters, or whatever Israel has in mind. It didn't work out very well. The Palestinians realized that there was an Israeli army unit that was sneaking into their refugee camp. They went out there to stop them from entering the camp. The Israelis killed 10 people, including a 61-year-old Palestinian woman, Ubaid, who was killed, was sitting in her living room. So they carried out a massacre, and it wasn't just the massacre that ignited the Palestinian anger. It's the fact that this massacre was the culmination of many months of such violent behavior. So it was basically the final straw. Palestinians rebelled and attacked Israelis and responded, and once again, mainstream media began talking about the escalation in Palestine, having absolutely no idea and no clue about all of this context that we have been discussing.
Exactly. And this daily atrocities, I mean, we watch on Middle Eastern television and satellite TV, home demolitions literally every single day throughout occupied Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank. For example, in Sheikh Jarrah, in Masafir Yatta, another area that is not talked about in the media, in Khan al-Ahmar. I mean, there are so many villages, so many areas that are literally being ethnically cleansed. People are being displaced by force. Their buildings are destroyed. And sometimes they are even forcing Palestinians to destroy their own homes or pay big-time money to the Israeli government to destroy their homes. It's just unbelievable.
It is, and there is a reason of why the house demolitions of recent months is somewhat different from the previous house demolitions. In the past, they would demolish homes sometimes under the guise of this is a closed military zone. We need to make sure that nobody is living here. This is a Israeli army firing range, or it's too close to this settlement, or to punish Palestinians for carrying out any attack within the vicinity of a particular village or town. But this time, Israel is talking about something that they call soft annexation. Now, annexation is illegal under international law. You can't just go as an occupying power, which means that you have clear legal responsibilities under international law. You can't just willy-nilly go and start, you know, annexing land and say, this is part of the, you know, my country's proper. It doesn't work that way. But Israel wants to do that. In fact, they have already done that. They have done it with the Golan Heights, the Syrian Golan Heights. They have done it with East Jerusalem in 1981. They've done it with the Golan Heights in 1980, I believe. And they are hoping that they could do this in an area called Area C within the West Bank. Area C within the West Bank is pretty much about 60% of the total size of the West Bank, and it includes the Jordan Valley. A year or so ago, the Netanyahu government, prior to Naftali Bennett, wanted to annex, and in fact, they passed, voted in the Knesset, and they agreed that we are going to officially annex the, you know, most of the West Bank. There was an uproar. The international community didn't like it. Even the Americans themselves found that to be a huge gamble, and they didn't like it. So the Israelis backtracked, but they didn't exactly backtrack. Instead of carrying out what they call annexation, like de jure annexation, as in legal annexation, they wanted to do de facto annexation, as in behaving as if they have officially annexed the place without making it law as of yet. Maybe in the future they hope to do so. And this is what Netanyahu is talking about. Now he's been referring to soft annexations, everyday annexation, a piece of land here, a piece of land there, Masafir Yatta, Khan al-Ahmar, and so forth and so on. And all of this is done in a very strategic way. If you look at the map, you will find that none of these areas that are either, facing all these house demolitions or under threat of being destroyed and ethnically cleansed, none of them are random. They are part of a very specific Israeli military plan in order for them to evacuate Palestinians living in sparsely populated areas and eventually claim these areas for Israel, whether to be allocated for settlement expansion, new settlements, or to join so-called Israel proper. So that's really the plan, and that's what Israel is doing. The only difference is that nobody seems to be noticing that there is soft annexation going on. So we keep talking about Masafiriyata and Silwan and Khan al-Ahmar and you know, the southern Hebron Hills and the Jordan Valley, but we are talking about it in a disconnected sort of way, as if each one of these areas is just a cause of its own. But there is a much bigger picture that we need to pay attention to, that this is the very annexation that Netanyahu proposed a couple of years ago. He is just finding a more clever way of annexing the West Bank without declaring with a fanfare that he is annexing the West Bank.
And they continue their plans to kick Palestinians out of occupied Jerusalem, where the Palestinians want that to be their the capital of their state, and Israel is saying absolutely not, no matter what. Actually, they are taking the Jerusalemite IDs from Palestinians, kicking them out, demolishing their homes, also escalating their atrocities against Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem. And that's one of the main focal points with this crisis that is ongoing with the Palestinian situation, right?
That's right. I mean, Jerusalem is at the heart and the center of Palestinian politics, the Palestinian political discourse, but also Israeli settler colonialism. They feel that if they really do manage to kind of wrestle the Palestinian, the Jerusalem entirely from the hands of Palestinians, it's just really kind of one of the final pieces of this puzzle that would allow Israel to finally kind of triumphantly declares victory over the Palestinians. But it's not working very well for them in Jerusalem. And it's not working very well for two reasons. Number one, the people are resisting. There is a new generation of extremely dedicated, clever, stubborn, tough Palestinians. They speak languages, they are on social media, they know how to organize, they know what intersectionality is, they know how to speak to the rest of the world, and they know how to connect to the cause of their own neighborhoods and villages throughout East Jerusalem with the rest of the Palestinian cause. And they have succeeded in doing so. I mean, we have seen the war of May 2021. It was the outcome of this. It was the fact that the rest of Palestine rose in unison in order for them to stand in solidarity with East Jerusalem, which is a huge victory for Palestinians, because this whole idea, let's segment and sectionalize Palestinians, let's divide them, and each one has his own little canton or his own little band to stand fighting for his own little rights here and there, that's not working out anymore. Palestinians are beginning to think once more that they are one nation fighting for one cause, whether they are Muslims or Christians in Palestine 48 or the West Bank or East Jerusalem, etc., etc. So this is really, really important. The other Israeli failure is that about 20 years ago, Israel had this plan called something like the Great Jerusalem Plan 2000. They wanted to ensure that the demographics of Jerusalem work perfectly in their favor, not just this year or next year, but permanently. They tried to find out this, to create this mathematical equation that would make Jerusalem, under any circumstance, always a city in which Jews are the majority and Palestinians are the permanent minority, if not eventually completely evacuated from the city. So they start accelerated their ethnic cleansing campaign of Palestinians, house demolitions of Palestinians, finding every possible way to take Palestinian homes, to give it to illegal Jewish settlers. But they also started changing the boundaries of the city entirely by defining and redefining the borders of what is Jerusalem, keeping the Palestinian population centers out and including newly built illegal Jewish settlements. And yet, as of 2-3 years ago, they realized that the math still did not work out. Yes, Jews are now the majority of Jerusalem because of all of these illegal acts, but they could not get the number exactly to where they wanted to be in order for them to guarantee permanent Jewish majority in East Jerusalem. So what we have been witnessing in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, and in these areas in recent years is this rage that is happening within the right wing, the far right, and the ultra-nationalists of Israeli politics, who feel that the jewel of the crown of their settlement project, Jerusalem, is actually not working out very well. And they are still not able to achieve that absolute demographic majority. And Palestinians are still there and still fighting. And that's why we have witnessed all of this. This is very important context because the same process is being repeated in the rest of the West Bank. Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's new minister of national security. I mean, this man is really no less than a terrorist. I mean, he is an extremely violent person who has been inciting violence for such a long time. He has been chasing after Palestinians repeatedly in Al-Aqsa Mosque and Sheikh Jarrah while holding a pistol. And now he is the Minister of National Security of Israel. And he wants to take advantage of the chaos created by Israel in Jenin and elsewhere to demolish so many Palestinian homes. He said he wants to demolish all the new Palestinian homes built in East Jerusalem because he understands that they need to do something so dramatic, so vile, so illegal in order for them to reduce the numbers of Palestinians living in the occupied city of Jerusalem. So the Israeli response wasn't as many expected, a war and air raids on Gaza, but it's a strategic response where they are going to go after the homes of Palestinians, after the lands of Palestinians, and selectively destroy, demolish, and seize according to whatever Israeli plan that the new right-wing government of Netanyahu has in mind.
And you know, with those colonies that we're talking about, there are approximately, is it 750,000 now, Israeli colonizers who live in colonies built on Palestinian land, and we're talking about only in the West Bank and Jerusalem, and that's on 22% of historic Palestine. So at least 750,000 live on them. And as you mentioned, Israel continues to expand these colonies. And then they take more Palestinian lands and more roads around these colonies in the name of securing these colonies. And the cycle continues to go on and on and on. I guess like you labeled it, soft annexation.
That's right. I mean, the fact, you know, when Israel says that they are building a new settlement site, they're not saying we are just seizing that particular, amount of land or this number of dunams in order for us to build a settlement. For Israel, city planning is a whole different process when it takes place in occupied Palestine. Why? Because Israel wants to make sure that not only this settlement exists, but this settlement is connected to all the other settlements nearby. And this so it's connected to all the network of settlements, illegal Jewish settlements in the West Bank, but it's connected to the so-called Israel proper. And that means they have to build highways. They have to build bypass roads. They have to demolish endless numbers of trees. They have to, if they need to demolish mountains, they have to do that. And then they have to create this massive area around it as a closed military zone to ensure that Palestinians do not bother this exclusively Jewish settlement. So it's not just the settlements. It's what also happens once the decision to build or to expand that settlement takes place, because a lot more Palestinian land is also expropriated in the process of doing so. This is why these 750,000 settlers are using most of the resources of the West Bank, despite the fact that you have millions of Palestinians living in the West Bank, but those settlers are using most of the water, most of the natural resources, and of course they have the freedom to travel, to move, to do whatever they want. Well, the Palestinians, and this is the irony of it all, because Israel controls the Palestinian water resources, the water resources of Palestinians are actually under the control of the Israeli water company. The Israeli water company steals the Palestinian water and turns around and sells it to the Palestinians at a very high price. Palestinians have to pay exorbitant prices in order for them to have access to their own water. You would say, why can't they build their own wells? Well, they can't. They actually cannot build wells. It's illegal under the Israeli military occupations law to build new wells. And when Palestinians misbehave, and by that I mean resist the Israeli occupation, Israel turns off the tap. So no water for you, no water for Jenin, no. And it happened repeatedly in the summer. These usually Palestinians are struggling. They are, you know, they have no access to clean water whatsoever. Well, on the other hand, the settlers have access to much more water, not just much more water than the Palestinians in the West Bank, but even more water than the average Israeli living in Israel. So they have abundance of water, plenty of water, swimming pools, whatever they need to, while Palestinians are struggling to find clean water to drink. And this water is actually Palestinian water, comes from the Palestinian aquifers in the West Bank. Another major violation of international law.
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Our guest in this episode of Arab Voices is Dr. Ramzi Baroud, a U.S.-Palestinian journalist, media consultant, author, internationally syndicated columnist, editor of Palestine Chronicle, and a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs. He is joining us via phone from Seattle, Washington, and we are talking about the ongoing Palestinian Nakba and the latest escalation of Israeli atrocities throughout occupied Palestine. And those Israeli settlers or colonizers, they are full of criminal activities. I mean, in Hebron and all areas throughout the West Bank, on almost daily basis, they burn Palestinian homes and businesses. They burn their cars, vandalism. They spray racist slogans on business walls and Palestinian homes with verbiage like death to the Arabs and death to the Palestinians and others I can't even say on the radio. They destroy Palestinian farms. They uproot their olive trees. In cases we've seen them on TV actually stealing these trees and replanting them inside their areas that they have stolen from Palestinians. Hundreds of these acts on a regular basis, and sometimes under the protection of the Israeli occupation soldiers. And they are all armed.
Almost always under the protection of the Israeli soldiers. And I like that term you use, the criminal activities, because I think there's something slightly changing about the nature of the criminal activities. We know that military occupation is a criminal act. It's a war crime. So it's criminal, yes? But what has changed, I think, in recent years in Israel is that in the past, the criminality of the illegal Jewish settler used to be used as a political tool to frighten Palestinians, to attack Palestinians. You create a situation in which the settlers are attacking Palestinian land somewhere in, let's say, near Al-Khalil, near Hebron. Palestinian farmers come to fight, you know, for their land. The Israeli army comes and says, you know what? This is an area in which there are too much bloodshed, too many clashes. So Jewish settlers, you are out, but Palestinians, you are also out of your land. And this land is now a closed military zone. You say, but wait a minute, how is that fair? But that's how it works. So the settlers were always used as a tool in the hands of the Israeli army to create situations in which that would allow the Israeli army to take more Palestinian land and to expand the settlements. But I think what has changed is that the militant armed Jewish settlers are no longer a marginal force in Israeli politics. Now, this is not news, you know, to anyone. I mean, this has been going on for quite some time. Netanyahu is particularly responsible for kind of changing the nature of Israeli politics and bringing the settlers from the margins to the driving seat of Israeli politics. They are at the core of Israeli politics. When you have the likes of Smotrich and the likes of Ben-Gvir, the likes of Ariel Dery, and these people were always, they were ever lucky if they were allowed to be, you know, a very minor player in an Israeli coalition government. Now they are the government. Israeli politics has been redefined so many times in the last two decades, to the point that the likes of Avigdor Lieberman, a person who was described even by mainstream American media as a fascist or a neo-fascist, he has suddenly become somewhat moderate, somewhere in the center of Israeli politics. Avigdor Lieberman did not change. The Israeli politics changed. So the center of gravity has been moving more and more towards the settlers. So think of all these criminal activities that you have discussed, and think that those criminal activities are no longer a tool in Israeli politics, but rather the actual policy of the government. This is why it's particularly frightening. And this is why many people are saying that Israel is pushing for a religious war. It's no longer about utilizing, using, or manipulating religion to achieve political ends anymore. It is actually about religion, because this massive constituency of religious zealots, of religious fanatics, now are the ones who are making policies in Israel on a daily basis.
And that's the new Israeli government that started just a few weeks ago. You mentioned some of their names. Obviously, everybody knows Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, who was prime minister before and was convicted, and charges against him for corruption and all kinds of stuff. Not to forget that he's a war criminal, regardless of what Israeli courts say about him. But you also mentioned some of the new ministers, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, the Minister of National Security, Smotrich, who has a significant power, as I'm reading about him, over Israeli colonies, in addition to his role as finance minister. And here is something interesting. You know, when we were talking about Jenin earlier, an Israeli Knesset member, Alman Cohen, said on his Twitter account, this is after the Jenin massacre, after the Israeli occupation forces stormed Jenin and killed 10 Palestinians. He said, quote, "Nice and professional work by the fighters in Jenin. Keep killing them," unquote.
You know, I mean, to be, you know, fair to him, you know, this is the political discourse of the Israeli government. I mean, we remember, what's her name, Shakid, who was the Minister of Justice in Israel, when she said that it's not enough to kill young Palestinians, you also have to kill their mothers as well, because the young Palestinians are just the, you know, they're little snakes. It's just the mothers who have to be killed. And the irony of all ironies is that she was the Minister of Justice. I mean, this doesn't happen in any other government in the world, no matter how nasty, no matter how weird, no matter how neo-fascist. The Israeli, and the thing is, why do the Israelis say these things? Why do they say them publicly? And why do they act upon them publicly? Because there is no accountability whatsoever. Basically, they have a blank check. They can do whatever they want to the Palestinians, and they are somehow perceived as the defenders of civilization. And when Palestinians resist and fight back, God forbid, they are the enemy of civilization. How is this fair? How is this just in any way? And it's not like the Palestinians don't know that. I mean, when Blinken arrived in the Middle East a few days ago, I mean, Palestinians were protesting left and right, because they know. They know that the U.S. is not a fair, you know, force in all of that. They are neutral. They're not neutral. They're not middlemen. They are very much on the side of Israel. And the Israelis also know that. They know that under no any circumstance the U.S. will ever put any real pressure on Israel to relent or to concede or to finally bring a measure of justice to the Palestinian people.
And I want to talk more about the U.S. Role in all of this, especially after all, it funds what Israel is doing and has been doing and will continue to do, unfortunately. But in terms of, while we're still on the new Israeli government, there are several new measures. Some of them are new, some of them are kind of, you know, really ongoing. But the new government is saying they are going to implement, such as stripping Palestinian families of their citizenship, trying to strip them of any national rights. Of course, we already talked about, they already said it publicly, we are going to expand the colonies, yes, on stolen Palestinian land. They are going to have death sentences to Palestinian resistance fighters who are caught. Netanyahu said he wants to expedite gun permits for Israeli colonizers, which I thought they already all carry guns regardless. And also, they're going to withhold money that they collect, tax money they collect on behalf of the Palestinian Authority, and they're going to hold it and not giving to the Palestinian Authority. And something new and interesting happened. I'm not sure that is relating to the new government, but I don't know if you've heard this, but just a few days ago, on January 29th, apparently the Palestinian archaeological entity, they discovered an archaeological site in the village of Sebastia in northern Nablus in the occupied West Bank. And literally hours after that humongous discovery, Israeli occupation forces stormed the area, brought 18-wheelers, and it's all caught on tape, and I watched it on TV, and they actually stole the artifacts from that archaeological site. Unbelievable.
It really is unbelievable, but it is also believable in the sense that they have been doing this for a very long time, especially when it comes to the archaeological digs and finds in Palestine. Professor Hamdan Taha, one of the Palestine's best archaeologists for the last 20, 30 years, honored us by with a great contribution to our latest book, Our Vision for Liberation, in which he talked about the struggle for Palestinian history, the struggle for Palestinian archaeology, how Israel immediately, the moment it acquired or it seized illegally Palestinian land in 1967, immediately went after the museums, renamed them. The Rockefeller Museum of Jerusalem is actually the Palestine Museum, and the constant theft of Palestinian artifacts and Palestinian history and Palestinian scrolls, all with the aim of replacing that, hiding the actual facts, the actual tangible artifacts that tell the history of Palestine and what a fascinating history it is, and to selectively replace it with this, you know, just fabricated narrative that erases Palestinians out of history altogether, from the times of the Canaanites and the ancient Hebrew and the Byzantine and all of that, all the way until today. So this kind of, this acrobatic view of history that Israel plays and continues to play, and sadly it's quite convincing to its followers in the U.S. and elsewhere. I guess people believe whatever it's convenient for them to believe. But this is, I mean, what you highlighted, you know, we rarely talk about these things because Israel doesn't give us the chance to discuss the issues that are quite important, but maybe do not seem urgent enough because of the daily killing. But this is very, very important for Palestinians. And again, no international accountability. What happened to the artifacts? What happens to the Palestinian discoveries that have been made? Who's going to be held accountable for that? There is no such thing. I just want to mention something very important about citizenship, though. About this whole idea of stripping Palestinians from this citizenship if they have been convinced of, or convicted rather, of carrying out so-called terrorist attacks. This is something that Ben-Gvir has been talking about for a long time. Ben-Gvir is more interested in Palestine 48. These are the Arab, Palestinian, Christian and Muslim towns and villages inside Israel. Because he believes that those Palestinians are fifth column. They cannot be trusted, and thus the constant citation of what took place in May 2021 when they rose in unison and in support and solidarity of their sisters and brothers in the rest of Palestine. So he wants Netanyahu to free his hands, to do whatever he wants to those Palestinians living in 1948. The attack on the settlers in East Jerusalem was not carried out by a Palestinian Israeli citizen. It had nothing to do with that. But Ben-Gvir is so keen on having that particular legal leverage that would allow him to start going after Palestinians, their activists, their intellectuals, anybody who is either accused of carrying out anything or sympathizing with Palestinians in any way or using any language that Israel deems to be insightful, etc., etc., in order for him to actually go after that new momentum that is happening within Palestine 48. So I think Palestine 48 is going to be a very important component in the story of Palestine in the coming weeks, months, and years. And in a way, it is a good thing. It is a good thing because we have been taught for many years that this component of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian struggle is no longer part of the struggle. We're just talking about the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, we're no longer talking about Gaza. We are talking about Area A and B and C of the West Bank. What Israel did not expect, that all the indoctrination, all the suppression, all the oppression of Palestinians in those areas actually never paid dividends. And they are ready to re-engage in the larger Palestinian struggle for freedom and for equality and for rights throughout all of Palestine.
One thing that Israel has always done and they continue to do is collective punishment. And now they are going to expel families of Palestinian resistant fighters from their homes in 1948 areas and in occupied Jerusalem. So if you are a fighter that resists Israeli occupation, that you attack Israeli soldiers because you don't want them to be on your land there killing you, they are going to expel that resistant fighter's families from their homes. Another measure that they are trying to implement to try to make the Palestinians not resist them, which is obviously failing.
It's failing, and it has been failing for such a long time. I mean, really, if you are in the position of the Israelis, and let's assume that there is some sort of political justification to their violence against Palestinians, just to entertain this idea for a minute, they haven't any more options. I mean, they don't really have any more tools. Palestinians have broken the fear factor, and the Israelis have done everything in their power to control them, to intimidate them, to isolate them, to break their spirit, make them, you know, turn against one another through factionalism one day, through regionalism the other day, and they have done all kinds of violence to make that happen. And yet, somehow, we are back to square one, as if none of these things have taken place. Palestinians are fighting, they're standing, they're unified at a street level, at a collective level, at a popular level. I'm not talking about factions and all of that. I'm talking about ordinary, what we call the new Palestinian, which is, this term is really quite interesting because now everyone is talking about the new Palestinian in reference to this new generation with this new spirit. But actually the term the new Palestinian was a term that was invented by the Americans themselves after 2005 when they tried to retrain the Palestinian Authority forces so that they are only used for security coordinations with Israel and to suppress any dissent among Palestinians themselves. And they called these new recruits of the Palestinian Authority, they called them the new Palestinian. Well, they did not expect that new Palestinian is going to be a whole different new Palestinian. And it's going to be the one who is actually fighting the Israeli colonial drive and challenging the Palestinian Authority and organizing and mobilizing on the street while trying to find the common ground between all Palestinians. The irony of it all.
You mentioned Secretary of State Blinken, because we know he visited the area and he met with Israeli leaders and with Palestinian leaders. And, of course, nothing new. It's the same old same, basically the status quo, which is Israel, keep at it, continue to do whatever you have been doing and what you need to do, which is war crimes and atrocities against the Palestinians. And we will continue to fund you. We'll continue to give you arms and provide you with over $3+ billion annually from U.S. tax dollars. In the meantime, you Palestinians, you better behave. Don't escalate. Will support two-state solutions, which doesn't seem that will ever, ever take place based on what you just said and what we all know and this ongoing expansion of colonies and land theft and so on and so on. So nothing really is new on the U.S. government side. You've probably heard a prominent journalist, Saeed Iriqat, whom I've had on this program several times, actually was grilling the State Department's spokesperson in a press conference or in a briefing just a couple of days ago about the occupation. Do you consider the Palestinians to be occupied in the West Bank? And he asked him that question so many times repeatedly because that spokesperson refused to say, yes, the Palestinians in the West Bank are occupied. I mean, This is not under Trump. This is under Biden. But why am I surprised? Biden himself said, I am proud to be a Zionist.
Yeah, that's right. You do not have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. I am not a Jewish and I am a Zionist.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I think this whole thing about Trump, how terrible Trump was, and, you know, we can't wait for Trump to leave in order for peace, the peace talks to resume. I mean, it was wishful thinking from the beginning. I mean, who did really Palestinians ever think that there would be a new president, whether Biden or anybody else, who really had the courage and the audacity to come and challenge Israel and to hold Israel accountable to international law? But I think one of the things that Blinken has said, that, you know, as he was leaving Israel Palestine today, he said that, you know, we are still committed to the two-state solution for the long term. Not now. We'll talk about it years from now. Despite the fact that intellectuals, historians, politicians, human rights activists, people on the ground, they understand that not only the two-state solution was never really serious to begin with, and nobody had actually the intention of making it happen when it was possible for it to happen, it is no longer practical, even if there is any sincere intentions of making it happen. And now the U.S. is committing to it on paper, but not now, in the future. Let's not even talk about it, which means one thing and one thing only. The U.S. is politically bankrupt when it comes to Palestine and Israel. They are still using and utilizing the old terms and just doing these jingoisms, but at the end of the day, they really have no new ideas. They have no imagination. They are politically broken, and they are just going to keep pushing this as long as it takes, not to upset Israel and Israel supporters in Washington, but they can't possibly go beyond this.
Even when Israel murders American citizens like Shireen Abu Akleh, who was murdered in Jenin in May 2022 by the Israeli occupation forces, or like when Israel murdered Rachel Khoury so many years ago in Rafah in the occupied Gaza Strip, the U.S. doesn't seem to care even about that. Dr. Ramzi Baroud, I want to ask you about what's next. We know the U.S. stance, obviously. It's money, arms, and U.N. vetoes to Israel 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, forever, no matter what Israel does. The international community, who, what? Arab countries, they are not just sympathizers with Israel. They are having normalized relations. They are actually now, and I'm talking about governments, of course, not the people. They are actually condemning the Palestinians for resisting the Israeli occupation. The United Nations, do they have any power to do anything? Doesn't seem like it. What is next for the Palestinians? What is the solution? What is the option?
That's right. I think the answer has to start from within the Palestinians themselves. The Palestinian people are giving us clues that we are no longer begging Washington to interfere or to make any difference or to come to the rescue. We are going to count on ourselves. So there is a new articulation of a Palestinian political discourse that is happening on the street of Palestine. And I think this is why the panic among Israelis, Israeli officials, and panic among Palestinian Authority officials. They feel like there's a new momentum and there's new blood and new thinking. We don't know where this is going to go, but I'm quite optimistic about it. The other thing is that the world is being redefined. The region is being redefined. Even Arab countries that have always fallen within the orbit of American foreign policy are challenging the U.S. over many issues. And I think this is unprecedented, especially if it's combined with the fact that after the indoctrination and the normalization and the media propaganda and the major shift away from Palestine, in pretty much all pan-Arab media with no exception, they have walked away from Palestine and they have other fights to fight. Yet when the Arab Opinion Index 2022 came out earlier this month, it was absolutely astonishing. It makes for such exciting read that the Arabs in the poorest countries that are fighting against civil war, fighting against corruption, fighting against, you know, political institutions that have absolutely no regard for Arab aspirations, every single one of these countries said, Palestine is not just the cause of the Palestinians, it's the cause of all Arabs. And the vast majority of them, starting with Algeria and Mauritania at 99% each, are against normalization with Israel. Now, you would say, but wait a minute, the Arab world is not a democratic space. Why should this matter? Well, it matters because there are ways even for non-democratic regimes to acquire a certain degree of legitimacy. Who wants to go against the 99% wishes of the people of Algeria and Mauritania, but also Qatar and even Saudi Arabia, very strong support for Palestinians? It means Jared Kushner has failed, the Abraham Accord has failed, normalization has failed, and there are new possibilities happening in the Middle East. It doesn't also mean that we give up on the United States. We don't give up on our local politicians. We don't give up on our charities and our NGOs and our activists. We continue to work together to push our government, our representatives, to hold Israel accountable. I am quite optimistic for the future, despite of all the terrible things that are happening, because the Palestinian people are rising once more.
Dr. Baroud, could you give a source of good information for our listeners who would like to follow what's happening there and have accurate reporting, maybe the Palestine Chronicles website or any other resources you recommend to them to get the facts, news, and analysis on what's happening there?
Absolutely. The PalestineChronicle.com is always a great resource. Electronic Intifada is, of course, a great resource. Palestine Deep Dive, an exciting new project, is an excellent source. And of course, there are many other sources in Palestine, but you can start there. And you can contact me personally through my website, ramzibaroud.net. And I'm happy to help in terms of recommending books, readings, websites, or whatever else.
And I will have links to all the sites you just mentioned on our website, arabvoices.net. The only time I have left is to thank our distinguished guest, Dr. Ramzi Baroud, a U.S.-Palestinian journalist, media consultant, author, internationally syndicated columnist, editor of Palestine Chronicle, and a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs. His latest book that he authored, the latest volume, co-edited with Ilan Papi, is titled Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. And I will have a link to that book on our website also, not the book itself, but how to get that book online. Dr. Ramzi Baroud, we are grateful for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Saeed, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.